Hi, and welcome to episode 89 of Fresh Out of Tokens podcast. This is Tanya, also known as Cypher of Tear, and I'm very, very excited and grateful to have a wonderful person with me, someone I've greatly admired and wanted to have on the show for a long time. I'm very happy to say that Unburnt Witch, Zoe Quinn, is here in the house. Say hi.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be on here.
Oh, you're so welcome. I'm really, really like hyped to talk about all the cool stuff that you're doing, including like your game and your book.
So many things. I have too many things at this point.
Too many things, but they're all awesome things. But before we get into all the cool stuff that you're doing, for those listening, whether it's your first or 89th time listening, you know that we have teas and other items in the I Need Diverse Games Spreadshirt shop, where we split the profits 50-50 with Chachi Bobings, who designed our logo and header. We have a blog to compliment the show, which is outoftokenscast.com. If you have questions, compliments, episode, or guest feedback, feel free to drop us a note at freshouttokens@gmail.com or follow us on Tumblr at outoftokenscast.tumblr.com, and of course follow on Twitter at outoftokenscast. So Zoe, I know who you are, and I'm sure many people listening know who you are, but for a quick recap, like what do you do these days? Because I know you're making games and writing books, but what else is going on with you?
That's like a question that gets progressively more awkward for me to answer. So I am currently working on two games, one of which is pretty secret. There may or may not be some ARG materials out in the wild right now. But the one that people are aware of is Project Tingler, which got overfunded on Kickstarter, and we're still super grateful for that. And it's been a wild ride working on that. I have actually come up with a proper name for it, which took longer than like prototyping the mechanics, cause it's just like the bar is so high. So technically when it's done, it'll be called, Pounded in the Butt by a Handsome Living Video Game Manifestation of the Life and Works of Dr. Chuck Tingle. I've got a book coming out this fall called Crash Override with a long subtitle, which, people will be able to see more about very soon, and I'm very excited to talk about more finally, but, you know, book publishing is a whole big thing that I'm new to. I also run Crash Override Network, which is a combination resource center, victims advocacy group, and a crisis helpline for people who are experiencing online abuse. So usually, you know, people might not know what that means. So the basics is like anything you can try to do to completely ruin and harm another person's life using the internet, that frequently escalates into abuse off the internet as well. We try to help people with the specific things that come with that, whether it's like dealing with information security, account security, trying to talk about the legal issues with people, hooking people up with lawyers, that sort of thing. Giving people guides to, you know, this is what this, this is the most likely thing that will happen if you report something to this platform versus, you know, whatever. And just like being able to talk to someone about this stuff who understands and isn't like, oh, just go offline. That's sort of mostly, there's a lot more stuff we do, but that's like sort of the big umbrella without me taking up entirely too much time trying to talk about that. I also just had a board game that I contributed to it's the Betrayal at the House on the Hill expansion, Widow's Walk. I wrote a campaign for that. And I know there's something else I had come out, but I can't remember it right now. So, oh, well.
That's okay. That's like more than your average bear. So it's totally okay.
Now I'm just thinking about a bear typing and I'm very happy.
Someone quick, when you hear this episode, find a GIF, and then we will include it in the show notes.
Yes, please. A cute bear keyboard GIFs.
Yes, or the Kermit GIF, except someone can Photoshop a bear instead.
Yeah, or like get Fozzie.
Yes, I'm sure there has to be a Fozzie GIF somewhere.
Yeah, there's a dire shortage of Fozzie the Bear memes in comparison to Kermit.
Okay, people listening, you have been given a mandate. Go find some Fozzie Bear GIFs and make memes.
Yes.
And I know you've talked about this, so if you don't feel like rehashing kind of your origin story in terms of like what got you into gaming and geekery, that's totally cool. Or if you feel like rehashing it for those who may not know that part of your origin story, we can go there.
I do like talking about it because it's like mine was super weird. at least feel super weird, because I talk, like, usually when I talk to, you know, other game designers, they're like, what the hell are you talking about? So I kind of came to games from a weird angle. I had we were pretty very, very broke growing up. And I had, like, a Game Boy that a friend of the family gave me with two or three games. And, you know, I would work all summer with kid jobs trying to get a new one and stuff like that. But primarily, I didn't really start gaming until my dad got a 3DO, which is this, like, console that kind of failed out in the mid-90s because, like, it's, like, this oddball thing that uses CD drives and had, like, internal hard drive. And it was, the whole thing was like, oh, video, like, we're putting the video back in video games, like, full motion video, blah, blah, blah. And I got it in 99, well after this had failed, because, like, part of the problem was the launch price was, like, $700 or something ridiculous like that, so most people didn't bother. So my dad got this, like, used gross cardboard box full of, like, a bunch of half-broken jewel cases with a bunch of the games in it. And that was, like, primarily my my intro into gaming for the longest time. Like, one of the first games I ever played was Night Trap, which, you know, I think that's one of the reasons I'm weird. The thing I really fell in love with, though, is Star Control 2, which, like, it came out in 94, but it had, like, full voice acting, this whole galaxy you could explode. Explore. Oh my God. That was a hell of a slip. Whole galaxy you could explore. And it's funny, like, I think Mass Effect kind of took a lot from that in terms of inspiration and stuff. But yeah, like, it was just an amazing game. And I was this, like, sad kid that had kind of a rough home life. So being able to sort of lose myself in this other galaxy, was really sort of magical to me. And I kind of fell in love with games super hard. Then I only started making games about 5 years ago, so I'm still a little bit of a newbie in relative terms to a lot of my contemporaries. But yeah, that's sort of how I ended up here.
Oh, that's so cool! Because I remember when you were on Spawnami and you were talking about that a bit, and I was just like, huh.
Oh yeah, talking about the Where's the Beef board game and everything.
Yes. I was like, wow, FMV, that was something I've not heard in many years.
Yeah, and, like, it's cool to be indie now, and it's like, oh, a lot of my friends have been like, I'm doing, like, a retro pixel art game, because, like, you know, that's the thing I grew up with, and I have a lot of affection for it, and now I'm like, haha, I'm doing that to you guys now, too, except it's a video, and it's weird. So, I'm getting my long game revenge.
There you go. I'm sure people are excited. I'm excited because I was just like, okay, even if it's just like $5, I have to pitch into the Kickstarter when I saw it.
Thank you. Yeah, it's like honestly one of the most fun things I've ever worked on, and I was so nervous going to Kickstarter for it because I'm like, this is weird for at least 6 different reasons. I have no idea if it's like one of those things that people think is funny. And will, like, laugh at the idea of, or if they're, like, they think it's funny enough that they'll, like, donate to it. Because, like, funny/cool enough, because it's not, like, it's pure comedy. We're just doing absurdist stuff about love.
Yeah, but it looks really cool, you know, from all the updates and everything. And then we're going to, like, get in-depth about the game in a bit. But first I want to talk about your book, Crash Override, and, you know, I'm sure this has been kind of a journey to getting it. So are you excited for it to kind of be out and be done with? Or are you more like, here's this book, go read it?
I'm pretty excited for it to be out and done with. And I hope that doesn't sound like I'm taking a dig at my work or anything. It's just like writing a book is such a long, drawn out process. And was very different from making games. Like when I first got the deal, I'm like, oh, this will be so much easier than making a game because like, I don't have to debug my book, you know, like I won't have to like make art and test that the animation's working and then do all this like ridiculous QA stuff for a book. I just get to write it. And I just only have to write one version of it. It's not like I have to account for what a player will do and like write, because like, with writing games, it's like you've got to account for this like secondary author of the player and their experiences and give them options and anticipate what they're doing. So it's like a lot more writing in a lot of ways. But with books, it's like, here are the words, done. And I'm like, oh, it'll be so easy. But it is, nope, no, it isn't, as it turns out. It's a lot of work. There's a lot that goes into it. And the weird thing with nonfiction, like fiction is so much more fun because you get to just sort of make up the rules as you go along. And even with Depression Quest, it was semi-fictional. But like, so even though it was like rooted in a lot of our feelings and experiences, you know, it's not like it's a one-to-one copy of my life, because like I didn't even have a lot of the advantages that I gave the player character. But the whole point of that was to show what happens when you lose things and showing the loss sort of thing. So it's like you have to start them out with something good. Anyway, but with actual nonfiction, it's like you have this giant dumpster of your own history and your own past, and you just kind of have to dive in there to try to find like a bunch of different needles that, you know, work to weave together something that makes a larger point and speaks to truth, rather than, you know, just trying to put everything down for the sake of 100% accuracy. Like, this happened then and that happened then, because like timeline stuff, even that is like, it gets messy. So it's like, it's hard, like sort of taking an editorial hand to your own life in terms of like how you structure stuff together and which stories you tell and which aren't, you know, good enough, in terms of like easily understood by a third, like by someone you don't know, to make your points and stuff like that. So it's like, it's very weird. And then trying to like take these really heavy experiences and this like dark stuff and convey it in a way that's both accurate, because people are going to be combing over this stuff like ridiculously thoroughly to try to find things to yell at me for. So it's like the accuracy is one thing, and then trying to make sure that it's stuff that I can prove in like triplicate backup with like all like, you know, a million copies of what I'm saying, in case anybody wants to try to start that fight. I know I can win it. And then once you have like that squared away, there's also like, how do I convey this feeling in a way that's like, doesn't sound melodramatic, but still has that weight and feel like expressing truth of feeling of like, you know, it's so easy to like go off and especially when you're writing about the internet, to write something that's very difficult for other people to understand, or something that seems like you're just making a big deal out of nothing. Unfortunately, because like one of the reasons I'm writing this, or I wrote this book, which is a weird thing to say in past tense, is like to push back against this, oh, it's just the internet, no big deal, stop posting, go offline stuff. So it's like already coming up against that sort of stigma of people not thinking it's real, and then having to say, yeah, the internet like almost killed me in a few ways, and have it, you know, land and not just immediately, you know, come off as nonsensical. So there's that element to it. And then there's like the other side of it, of trying to make it not so ridiculously, like you're inherently writing about ridiculous shit. So trying to make it make sense to somebody and not just be like a million beats of sad darkness, so that people, you know, don't get the wrong impression, because the internet still is the best thing that's ever happened to me, even though I've been through all this shit. And like trying to give people hope at the end too, like the book has a lot of very practical stuff, and I didn't want it to just be this thing where it's like, look at this sad thing that happened to me, and then like waiting that out with making sure that I'm not trying to speak to the whole of everybody's experiences from my position. So it's like finding other people that have been through this, like especially like trans women of color and people that aren't from the US, and like making sure their voices are included and giving people further reading on this stuff. It's like so many plates to juggle. Like, nonfiction is not fucking around. At least like if I'm writing something about dragons, nobody can say, well, that's not actually correct about dragons. Their internal temperatures are way higher than, I mean, people can, and those, at least those arguments are like fun to have. Like it's like totally frivolous and fine. But I mean, the stakes are way higher when you're writing about serious issues. And like, especially with anything memoirish, you have to leave so much out about your own story just for the sake of being able to get what you're trying to communicate across, and like being able to be okay with that and be like, yeah, this doesn't contain the whole of my experiences, and just trying to like represent the issues well, using your life, this sort of like weird objectification of your own history and your own experiences, to serve a greater purpose it's weird. It's super weird. And like, you change so much over the course of writing a book too, that like, yeah, it's going to be weird when it finally comes out and be like, yeah, I wrote all that like a year ago or whatever. and, you know, stuff changes, like, especially when you're doing anything tech-wise, stuff moves at a million miles an hour. So, yeah, again, that was, like, a super long-winded answer. So I'm very excited for it to be out and done with. I think, if nothing else, since there's a lot in the book that's just pragmatic guides to, like, here's how to like, protect yourself. Here's how to help other people that are under attack. Here's how to just live online in a way that's more humane and better and informed than you might have had before you came to this book. So I'm excited for all of that info and, like, the stuff that I'm putting directly into people's hands. I'm super happy and looking forward to them having that. And I'm hoping that, you know, at least a few people are able to do better for each other. And in these circumstances where someone's getting, like, super abused online, you know, people feel less like they can't do anything. If it does that for just, like, a few people, then I feel like I will, like, it'll be worth the years of work and strain and everything.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be great because you've already got great resources out there, and you've spoken more than anyone I think has a right to ask of you about these issues. So, you know, I'm grateful for the work that you do and for talking about this. And, you know, it's kind of like, here's the book. You can stop asking me these questions. Your resources.
Yeah, exactly. And I feel extremely honored that I'm able to tell my story because I know there's so many people who don't get to. And I do actually dedicate the book to everybody who, you know, watched the world tell their story wrong and never got a chance to correct them. As much as it's like, yeah, I've kind of been blue in the face for talking about this for like 3 years now. I'm glad that, you know, I can do something with it and, you know, try to do honor and to other people that might not be able to, and try to, you know, push for a world where nobody has to feel like that ever or be in that position.
Yeah. And there's something really powerful in that. And, you know, acknowledging that, you know, a lot of people don't get to tell their story because so many people get sucked up in kind of no quote unquote feeling they know, like, the truth or the story. They forget about all the people who don't get a chance to have their voice.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like something that I watched unfold so many times when, you know, when what was happening to me got so big and in the public eye, is like so many people that I had heard, you know, I'd read news about or heard basically internet folklore about, I'd end up actually talking to them and, like, finding out all the stuff that got left out, finding out all the stuff they couldn't say, finding out all the stuff that was just made up. It was just like such a mind fuck. And it's so important to remember that, like, even though the internet gives us unprecedented access to each other, it's very inaccurate. It's very dangerous to assume that you know the totality of someone just because, you know, you can see their Twitter feed sometimes.
Yes. I mean, you've seen me rant about that the other day. So
yeah.
If I start on that path again, it'll be a really long show.
Fair enough. Like, Lord knows I could fill an hour just ranting about it.
I mean, we could just talk about that briefly, but, you know, I know myself because I get on those rants, especially, you know, and you've been a really great friend to talk to you about kind of the shift to being more public and people not realizing you are a person.
Yeah, the internet's, like, super weird, right? Because it's like we start out and we're just being people on it and doing our thing. And it's like there's this weird gradient that, like, you end up, like, if your work's successful and like, really catches to a certain extent, like, it's not like an instant change. It's not like, oh, I'm a public figure now. It's like, it just slowly kind of happens to you. And it seems like it's other people's decision and not yours to a certain extent. And it's like, mm-hmm. that's like such a hard dynamic to navigate. And I don't think it's one that, like, I see when like people get into these, like, big deal YouTubers or whatever, get into these public scandals and stuff. It's like, they haven't gotten the memo that they're a public figure now and that they, you know, it's like, yeah, you have this audience but that, like, it isn't just a cool thing. It's something that comes with a lot of responsibility. And, you know, if you don't go out, if you don't start out seeking that, you know, the way that, like, a politician or, like, a Hollywood actress might, right? If mm-hmm. it's just like, oh, I'm just doing some goofy shit, especially if I'm doing goofy shit with my friends. Like, I think it's easy for people to not actually be paying attention to their footprint anymore. And that's, like, super frustrating.
Yeah. And yeah, there's so much more. I mean, that could be a whole other like series of episodes unto themselves.
Yeah, that's true.
And you can always come back. We can chat about that too. But you know, you talked about the difficulty and the difference in writing nonfiction. But I was wondering, are there other books you want to write? Maybe something about game development, motorcycle maintenance, you know, the art of Zen and motorcycle maintenance with some game dev thrown in, something.
I mean, that was the game of Zen and motorcycle maintenance. yeah, I mean, I definitely have a few books in me still, I think. I would really, really love to do a comic one of these days, like a graphic novel. I have one that I've sort of been sitting on for a while. Well, sorry, I have two that I've been sitting on for a while. But it's like, there's so many other things I'm doing like right now that it's like, oh, I can't wait to get like one of these things off my plate so I can just like, you know, do another side project that's in a medium I haven't done anything in yet. So I would love to write like a graphic novel, sort of autobiographical thing about growing up in the backwoods as like a queer kid with all this like sort of white trash folk magic stuff happening. Cause like I grew up in biker culture and there's like a lot of weird folk magic, sort of around that sort of thing. And there's parallels to that sort of stuff for me and how I felt when I started interfacing with the internet and started like getting any sort of tech literacy is like, oh, this is magic. Like magic is real. It's just, you know, making stuff online and having these like, it's like so cool to be able to just materialize all this digital stuff. And I'm doing disservice to the premise, but it's like, I never see stories told accurately about kind of where I come from. Like I come from like pretty backwoods stuff. I never see really that accurate portrayal of biker culture or that kind of like, I don't know. It's like, I've never seen stories told about people like me. So I kind of want to do that if nothing else. Cause I feel like there's probably some other weird kids that grew up in that sort of space. And if somebody had made that, I would feel so seen and like, that would be such like a neat feeling. So I kind of want to see if I can give that feeling to other people.
Oh, that'd be so cool.
Yeah.
Cause like, biker culture is something like I've always been fascinated with, but I'm also terrified of motorcycles. So,
and like, Lord knows it's like riddled with problems. I'm continually grateful that I'm, you know, I'm not there anymore as much as I love my family and stuff, but yeah, it's a very weird set of rules and not a ton of people leave.
Yeah. Well, if you write the book, I will definitely read it.
Awesome. So it's on my, I have like a shelf, like a mental shelf of projects, and it's definitely on there.
Cool. So you brought up Crash Override briefly, and you know, it's a great resource. I often send it to people, especially when they don't realize how much of their personal info is out there.
Mm.
And, you know, and unfortunately I've had reason to use Crash Override for other reasons. But I was wondering kind of like, you know, where do you see it going? Do you see it kind of still existing as this resource or do you see it expanding or changing over the next year?
So right now, what I'm trying to do with it is I'm working with a couple people to sort of retool the crisis helpline element of mm-hmm. it. Because like I was definitely not prepared for the scope at which people would be seeking services. And when you're someone who has been face down in this stuff for 3 years, it's a careful balancing act of, you know, trying to manage juggling your trauma with being useful to other people. And, you know, having been through stuff like that myself definitely was more of an asset than a detriment by far. Cause I at least knew what to tell people and I could, you know, do so in a way that was like, they knew they weren't just getting some like platitude or hot air blown up their ass or anything like that. But at scale, like it was at the point where it was like, I couldn't, like if I was just like getting really into programming something or working really hard on the book, I would have to like multiple times a day, drop everything to go try and help somebody. So it's like, I'm working with a couple people to sort of make that actually function at scale. And, you know, create basically take all of the info I have out of my brain, codify it so that other people that have like even more extensive training than I do in terms of mental health services and counseling and stuff like that could be able to sort of fill the role that I've been running myself ragged doing, and like do so in a way that makes sure that, you know, nobody has to wait to hear from us, you know, that we're able to handle every case well and thoroughly and be able to do like additional check-ins after people are sort of out of the crisis mode and stuff like that. So I'm working really hard on trying to figure that out and scale that and structure it. And I've got some good people on board right now that are helping me with that transition. And it's like a godsend to sort of be able to build on what we had already. And that way I'm hoping if like once the crisis element of it is a bit less something that I need to be on 24/7 and like really juggling very actively day to day and being on call forever, then I'll have more, like if that's being well and adequately handled by people that are doing a good job, I can do more things like create more guides and, you know, the stuff that, you know, is less day to day and more building on what we already have for people that, you know, might not want or need to go to the helpline itself, that just need quick answers or whatever thing, or like even making tools so people can sort of be able to do stuff on their own and not have to like wait. And I think there's like a fair bit of empowerment that comes from being able to solve your situation yourself if you're given the tools. Not that everybody has that option, but in cases where it's like, oh yeah, I'm like super terrified that this thing's going to happen and I feel powerless. Oh wait, I'm not powerless. Look at the stuff I have. I want to try to make more stuff available for people that are in that situation. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's really cool. And you know, being able to count someone a tool is like, you know, here, go forth. This should help or can be a help is really awesome.
Yeah. And then it's like, I don't have to be the person doing it every single time because there's only one of me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, do I know what you mean with that? Because I've lamented the fact I don't have a clone a lot this week. Mm-hmm. So, you know, serious stuff kind of aside, I want to talk about the fun game you're making based off Chuck Tingle's works. And we have the proper title now, which I will put in the show notes for everyone. And I'm sure there's stuff that you have filmed or outtakes or stuff that may or may not make it into the final game. So I was wondering, like, what's kind of a wild thing that got on film but may not be seen in the final cut?
There's, like, a lot of silly goofs that happened on set. Because the first time we were shooting assets, I was, like, trying to take more traditional film-ish type approach to it. So it's, like, doing takes and stuff like that. But when we're shooting like character animations in particular and stuff that's going to be like stripped of audio and manipulated by me in post, I like leaving the camera on because we end up getting some really natural, cool things when people are just, you know, not trying to do the thing. They're just kind of hanging out. And some of our best stuff comes from that. And that actually does make it in the game. Like one of the characters has like a nervous tic where he sort of picks his nose a little bit because the actor was like in between takes, like pulling down on the nostrils of the unicorn mask. And the character that he's playing is this very enthusiastic, high energy, but kind of twitchy guy. So like having him when he gets stressed out, like pulling on, like picking on his nose a bit, like super works for the character. So that was a delight to just kind of have. We're filming a lot of stuff for the behind the scenes stuff for backers. And I think we're debating putting out like a longer collector's edition type thing so that people who didn't back it and might want to see more after the game comes out can have that. So I'm like trying to record a lot of stuff. Like I just went out to do PAX East and I recorded a bunch of video of that since doing that sort of like on the road hustle is a big part of a lot of people's indie game development cycles and definitely part of ours. So and it's not one you really get to see a lot. So I thought it'd be cool to have a little bit behind the scenes of that. There's like the stuff of trying to make the practical effects, like the jiggly butt, which is like, it sounds silly, but it's like a, it's a pretty major part of the game is this jiggly butt. And like, it's been fun. It's been a fun process for me, someone who's got like zero practical effects experience, learning how to do all this stuff for the first time and like getting latex molding stuck in my hair and, totally messing it up, but having a blast while I do it. So there's a lot of stuff like that. And just like goofing around with actors and the other people working on the game. I absolutely love my team. It's been, everybody that's like on this project has been so enthusiastic and brought such a cool energy to it. And we're just all being enthusiastic gay babies together. It's great.
That's so cool. And, you know, I can hear it in your voice when you talk about the game. So I'm super excited to play it when it's out.
Cool. I'm excited too. I'm very, very much looking forward to how people are going to react, because I have no idea what a post launch of something like this looks like, outside of like a little bit of a peek for when I was doing voice acting for Jazz Punk. But like, I think this might even be a little bit weirder. And Luis, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry, don't yell at me.
Please don't yell at Zoe. So depending on how all this shakes out, do you think you'll make other FMV games?
Yeah. I mean, I've really enjoyed filming all of this, which was not something I was expecting at all. I'd like to start doing some kind of video content for the internet in general, if I can figure out a good home for that. But you know, I think there's a lot of stuff that FMV hasn't been thoroughly explored enough for, and I feel like there's a lot of stuff FMV can do that maybe mocap isn't quite as good at. Like LA Noir, when I saw the interrogation scenes, I'm like, why is that not just like FMV? Like, it would make, like, you're going through all this work to rig up the actors' faces and, you know, have that realistic depiction. They did like a really good job, but it's like, that could have just been FMV. And it's like, I know you couldn't have the open world elements and stuff to it for that, but like, I think there's like room for a cool detecting, like lie detecting police interrogation thing, kind of like Her Story. There's like, comedy is, I think, super untapped for FMV, considering that so much of comedy can be like via delivery, and having like actual video of people delivering in their very human mannerisms, I think, has a lot of potential. So yeah, I have a lot of other things I'd like to do with FMV, but and I've got the other project sort of roiling in the background, and I don't want to say too much about it, but yeah, definitely.
Awesome. Okay, so this is one thing. This is just my total, like, one concession to fangirling, because I was really excited to see this. But you got to meet Chuck Tingle, and, you know, a lot of people think, like, he is a myth, he isn't real, etc. But I was wondering, like, A, how did that even, like, kind of come about? And B, is he, like, totally just awesome in person?
So the way it came about was kind of surprising to me, too, because I saw that he was going to come out and be on at midnight, and I'm like, oh, that's Los Angeles. I live in Los Angeles. So I sent him a DM really quick, and I'm like, hey, I just saw that you're coming out. If you have time and want to see the game, we'll like totally respect your privacy and stuff, like no pressure at all. We're in the area. Let me know. If not, that's totally fine too. And the day that he was on it, I got a message kind of late in the day. He's like, oh, I just saw this. But in what we've colloquially started to call Tinglish, so in his manner of speaking, he's like, yeah, it's been a long day. We probably don't have time before we leave. And I'm like, yeah, that's fine. It's fine. I know it was kind of and he's like, I wish I saw this earlier. And I'm like, yeah, sorry. It's cool though. Don't worry about it. So the next day went by, and I figured, you know, he probably flew out in the morning, but late that night I get a DM being like, hey, we actually do have some time tomorrow morning. Would that work? And I'm like, yes, absolutely. And I like freaked out in the team Slack. I'm like, oh my God, everybody, Chuck is in town. He wants to meet us. It's going to be great. So he stayed in character the entire time. I was not sure if that's how that was going to go down. I was like, oh man, I was so nervous. It's like, do I want to know, like, what if I already know who it is, or what if it's going to be like this scene from, I think, Justice League that I kept thinking about, where Lex Luthor, I think, gets body swapped with the Flash, And he's like, finally, I'm going to know who this guy is. And he takes his mask off in the mirror. And he's like, I have no idea who this is. I'm like, is it going to be like that? What if he's a super jerk? What if I should? And the other element is like, I had shown him like almost nothing about the game so far. Because like I was running myself ragged, trying to really dump a lot of production values and a lot of effort into this game to sort of make this like overarching, intense fan art at somebody, that I could then surprise him with. So it's like, oh no, what if he hates it though? Which I know is like, it's irrational because I think it's great, but it's still like, oh God. So yeah, he came in, he stayed in character the whole time. I have not seen his face. We showed him the game. He was super excited and very surprised, I think, that I had gone to the lengths that I have to really kind of like put some serious production values into this game. And yeah, and it was really good. He gives extremely good warm hugs. I don't know any more about him than the general public still, I'd say.
That's cool, though, that you got to meet him.
Yeah, it's like meeting your imaginary friend.
Cool. Because, you know, like, I knew of his work because of Mark Oshiro.
Mm, yep.
And I love Mark. I adore him. Hopefully I can see him when I'm there next week.
Yes.
Mark, if you hear this, it'll be before I get in town. But, you know, I heard of Chuck's work through Mark. And then at Convergence last year, he did a reading of something Chuck wrote just for him to read at Convergence.
Oh my God, he told me about that. Like, I had not seen his work until I met him face to face at the Hugos, because when I got there, everyone's like, oh, you need to talk to Chuck's other friend. And I'm like, what? Chuck, like, there's someone else who has this extremely specific relationship with this extremely specific person. I like almost cried when I met him, because we were just like talking about like how we are both friends with this like character. And like the stuff that's come along with that. And he told me the story about, how Chuck got him to dramatically read a story he'd written about him dramatically reading the Chuck Tingle things. And it was lovely. It was like a completely surreal experience that was like piled on top of several other surreal experiences. And plus, Mark's just a great guy. So it's like, It was really cool. It's so cool. This whole, I really need to like for GDC and PAX next year, pitch a postmortem on this game, because the whole story from like start to finish, the fact that this started out like as a way for me to troll my friend Eliz, it's just been a fun story.
Oh my God. I would be front row center for that. And Mark, if you hear this, we totally all have to get together, because hopefully I will see you. Because I just adore him. I met him at Capricorn, and everyone's like, oh my gosh, you have to meet Mark. And actually, N.K. Jemison told me about his work because he had read some of her stuff.
Oh, cool.
And I was just like, you're awesome. I like you. And then friendship was born. Wow. Yes, he is amazing. And I'm sure we could probably talk about Mark for a whole hour too, because he's awesome.
Yep.
Yes. So I hope his ears are burning when this episode comes out. Me. well, you know, but beside writing books and making games, you have so many cool hobbies. Like you ride Harleys, you do fire spinning, which I didn't know until you met another friend of mine. and then you like experiment with body modification, magnetic implants and stuff. So it's just like, you have all of this cool stuff that you do. So I was wondering, like, among all of the non-worky things that are hobbies or just fun things, what do you do for the rare and elusive downtime?
Oh God. Like that answer would have been, probably would have been different before, book and Kickstarter crunch hell. I guess the truest answer I could give is trying new things is sort of my hobby. So which is kind of like how I've picked up so many weird ones over the years. Like I'll read about something and then immediately be like, oh, that sounds cool. I want to know everything about it. So I'm going to just do it and like super immerse myself. Like that's sort of how I ended up in pro wrestling school somewhat recently. That and a combination of a misspeaking on Twitter, and when I said I was going to get into wrestling, like, as a viewer, people thought I meant as a wrestler, and I'm like, you know what? Why not? And that's how I got a concussion. But I don't know. I'm just generally an extremely curious person, and I really like trying new stuff for the first time. There's like a whole slate of stuff that I haven't done yet that I sort of want to try when I have a bit of breathing room after book stuff calms down a little bit. But yeah, I just, if something looks cool, there's basically very little filter between that looks neat and I'm just going to do it. And I'm going to extremely do it. And if it's like really good, it might become a thing I do regularly, but if it's just fine, I'll be like, oh cool, I'm glad I did that, and never touch it again.
That's really cool. Mitchie got me to do fire spinning, and once I got over my fear of burning myself, it was actually fun.
It's like, it's surprisingly hard to burn yourself when you're spinning. Like, if you're using the right fuel, the flame point is pretty low. The biggest thing you have to worry about is hair. It gets real dangerous if you get into fire breathing, though, just because it's like so easy to get fuel in your lungs, which gives you this really nasty kind of pneumonia, and people can die from it. But just as far as spinning goes, like, that's like, it's safer than it looks.
Yeah, which I discovered, because I was just like, I could never do this. I will like smack myself in the face and singe my eyebrows off or something.
Right? Like, that, I think that's kind of what drew me to it too. It's what drives me to a lot of things. It's like, oh, I couldn't do that. I'd be like, then I guess my trollish nature is like, oh yeah, you want to see me? we'll see about that. And then I just end up doing ridiculous stuff. And usually, like with stand-up comedy, I was like freaked out the entire time, but I still made myself do it, and I'm really glad I did.
Yeah, are you like that Kermit meme where it's like the good and the bad Kermit?
Oh god, aren't we all though?
True. Very true. but speaking of comedy and public speaking and talking, you do a lot of it, you know, whether it's a GDC talk or PAX or just, you know, other stuff that you're doing. And I was wondering, what is actually your favorite thing to give talks about?
I would definitely say that my favorite thing to give talks about so far has been comedy and games. I strongly believe that my comedy and games talk, which is like on the GDC vault and free and stuff, if people want to go look, is probably the best talk I've ever given. It's either that one or the XOXO talk about, like, oh, why do people online suck? Where I'm like, hey, I was one of those people, and we need to stop viewing them as those people, because that is a really easy way for us to not examine our own shitty behaviors and blah, blah, blah. But definitely comedy. Like, I could go on about comedy and games for an extended period of time, because, like, I have so many thoughts about it. Like, it's consumed my thinking for the past several years, basically. Since I started making games, like, the first game I ever made is a comedy game. So yeah, there's like so many different complex bits of it. And when I get started, I have a hard time shutting up. So that's definitely, it's always like just like a positive, fun, enthusiastic thing to talk about too.
Yeah. Cause there's not a lot of talks about the comedy aspect of games. Cause whenever I'm funny, it's totally on accident. I have no idea if I could actually like intentionally be funny in a game.
It's weird. It's weird and hard because, like, you lose perspective on what is and isn't funny very quickly when you have to look at your own joke so many times. And, like, through the process of development and debugging, it's, like, very easy to, like, get too inside your own head. So you have to, like, really kind of have a super deep understanding of just comedy structure and, you know, like, just the guts of how a funny do. To be able to like keep any sort of perspective. And, you know, first time testers are always really good for helping keep your head in it. I worked on a comedy game I never finished for about 3 years, which was going to be like my first really big game. And that's one of the first things I learned is like trying to do that alone sucked. Cause like I'd show people the game and they'd laugh in places. I had just like spent 2 seconds and through like a placeholder text thing without any thought there. But like jokes I worked super hard on weren't getting the laughs that I wanted and stuff like that. And it was just like, oh God, I'm entirely inside my own head right now. And it was like really kind of a weird experience.
Huh. Well, hopefully you get a chance to talk about that stuff more, because I would totally listen.
Cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I know people listening might be like, oh my God, would you stop like fangirling? But this isn't fangirling. It's like admiration for someone I think is really cool.
And the admiration is mutual.
Oh, thank you. So, you know, in terms of things that we've talked about things that you want to talk about, and, you know, and I like to ask this question because I think a lot of folks overlook things we don't want to talk about. They just kind of plow ahead and think, oh, well, you're known for X, so therefore I'm going to ask you about X all the time. So I was wondering, what is the one question or topic you don't ever really want to be asked about again?
The one specific question that I have not wanted to be asked since about my fourth week of being a game developer is, what's it like to be a woman in games? Like, I understand where people are coming from when they ask that specific question, but it's like such an oversimplification, and it's like one person could even speak for many, right? And it's like, it was always frustrating seeing people that weren't women being asked interesting design questions and workflow questions, and then I had to answer, you know, the super specific to gender question. And it's like, well, for a long time, my only answer that I'll give if asked that question is, well, you get asked that question a lot, and that's it. Like, I will not elaborate. So which is probably, like, I know that's a little bit obstinate, but it's like, I feel like a lot of people that go into games end up having to, if they're not like a straight white man, and cis and all these things, like having to answer the what's it like to be a blank in games stuff so much. It's like we all have to do that for like several years when we start, and then eventually people are like, you know what, I'm kind of over this, and people are on their own timeline. Some people are always patient and gracious and able to answer that question without, you know, a hint of, hey, that's a really frustrating thing to be asked. And I super respect and commend the hell out of people with that level of patience. And some people just refuse to ever answer it. And I respect that level of self-respect, you know. But it's just like the question that it, like, causes a visceral feel, like a strong feeling in my gut of, oh God, this, why this? So that's definitely the one question I would just never like to be asked again, especially because of like other complications with gender stuff. And it's just, it's like, I'd rather not ever.
Yeah. And can we stop having women in games panels?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting watching diversity panels try to figure themselves out. And I respect people that, like, pull off good ones. But, you know, like, I think, I'm trying to remember if it was, I think it was 2 years ago. I'm like, hey, just so you know, I'm not going to sit on any diversity panel ever again if there's, like, no, if there's only white people on it, or if there's only, if there's, like, nobody that's queer or trans on it, just FYI. And I've turned down a lot of those panels since, and it's, like, sometimes it's like not for lack of trying on the organizer's part, but like I feel like I don't need to contribute to monopolizing the space of who gets to talk about those issues. And, you know, that space is definitely overwhelmingly white right now. And so it's like, yeah, not, I don't need to do this.
Yeah, I had a moment about that at GDC. So, because two panels I went to, both were diversity panels, but very, very white.
Right.
And I'm just like, really? Can we not?
Yeah. And like at a certain point, it's like you just kind of get tired of having to say the same thing. And I kind of feel like that's where I'm at on diversity panels. It's like, I feel like I've done the diversity panel in multiple different iterations enough now. Like, I'm just kind of over having to say the same thing from my own point of view. So it's like, I'd rather just be on panels that are more relevant to hobbies and design choices and my work, than, you know, only the diversity panels, which, you know, it's nice to be invited to, and I'm glad they happen, but yeah, I'd like to, it, I'd like to be, sometimes I just want to be a game developer, not a game developer with like some kind of, you know, sorting qualification in front of it.
Yeah. Hopefully next year. Hopefully next year.
Yeah.
Well, before we get into questions that people mailed in for you, you know, other than like book game, all of the other stuff you're doing, is there anything going on that you can talk about that we may not have covered?
Oh no, I don't know. yeah, I mean, it's like until the game drops, just, you know, for the, to sort of honor the faith and funding that our Kickstarter backers have put in the project, I'm pretty much chilling on everything else that I don't absolutely have to be doing right this second. Just because, you know, I feel very devoted to both the game and to the people who believed in us enough to help us make it. So it's as much as many places I'm spinning right now, like it is, I've definitely taken a number of large steps back in order to focus more on this one thing and getting that done and getting it perfect.